This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Good afternoon. It's Thursday, April 11th, 2024, and for the next hour, we will be bringing you news from the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. This is Harry reading with Beverly, live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. And you know, we rarely do audio description on these news shows, but if I were to describe the two of us, you know, I'm wearing the typical guy blue, and Beverly is wearing this beautiful peach-colored sweater. Anyway, on to the obituaries, which we usually begin with. First up, Barbara Ann Bryant from Paxton. Barbara Ann Bryant, formerly Barbara Ann Bowles, age 70 of Paxton, died from a long illness. Predeceased by Philip and Blanche Healy Bowles and brother Stephen Bowles. Survived by brothers William and his partner Ellen Parker, Robert and James Bowles. Also survived by her son, Jason, and Kelly Bryant, and Scotty Bryant, and her grandchildren, DJ, Davis, Lydia Bryant. Services are to be held April 20th at 11 o'clock at St. Richard's of Chichester in Stirling. Once again, that was Barbara Ann Bryant, formerly Barbara Ann Bowles of Paxton. Next, Robert Hunt Stebbins, Melbourne, Florida. Robert Hunt Stebbins died peacefully on April 5th in Melbourne, Florida. He was 85 years old. He was the son of Robert Clough and Marjorie Hunt Stebbins. He is survived by his wife, Meg Gilmer Stebbins, and his five children, Lisa, Julie, Diane, Teresa, and Robert. He had 12 grandchildren and one great-grandchild. He also leaves his German Shepherd, April. Bob loved dogs. He and his wife, Meg, always had a German Shepherd. He enjoyed his beautiful home in Melbourne, Florida, where he was surrounded by butterflies, tropical birds, flowers, and trees, blue skies, sunsets, and water. Every year he journeyed back north as he loved the beauty of the New England spring, summer, and autumn. Bob was a graduate of Northborough High School, where he was a four-star athlete, and Tufts University and Clark University. I believe that was meant to say at Tufts and Clark. For most of his career, he was a history teacher at Algonquin Regional High School in Northborough. His wife and children are often approached by alum claiming that Mr. Stebbins was their favorite teacher due to his passion for history, politics, and current events. A traveling enthusiast, Bob and his wife Meg took seniors annually on a class trip to Bermuda. In retirement, he and his wife and family traveled to many countries abroad. He had just returned from a trip to Barcelona. A former harness horse racer by hobby, he had a passion for horses, and he and his family went annually to the Windsor and Freiburg fairs at Saratoga Springs. Bob and his wife also enjoyed camping with their RV. They had visited every state. He enjoyed following football and golf and playing Texas Hold'em. Bob always had a good story to tell and was very funny. His family would like to thank the staff at Melbourne Regional Medical Center and St. Francis Reflections Life Stage Care. He donated his body to science. There is a little less color in the world today. That is Robert Hunt Stebbins. Next, Rita Teresa Berryman, Auburn. Rita Teresa Berryman, age 89, died Monday, April 8th, after a sudden illness. She was born in Worcester, Mass., daughter of the late Ernest and Pearl Vincent. She devoted her life to her husband, Henry, and to raising her two children, Glenn and Mark, having lived in Auburn, Massachusetts for close to 60 years. Rita loved vacationing in Hampton Beach, playing pitch, long drives with Henry, WWE wrestling, eating lobster, followed by maple walnut ice cream, and going out to eat at many area restaurants. She leaves behind her loving husband of 67 years, Henry, her two children, Glenn, and his wife Jessica, and Mark of Auburn, Massachusetts, her beloved granddaughter of Holden, Massachusetts. Rita, or Grandma, as many called her, was just 4 feet 10 inches and a mere 80 pounds, but her personality and character were larger than life. Her spunk and wit made all who had the fortune of meeting her smile. Having had 2 boys, Rita was thrilled and overjoyed when Jackie, otherwise known as their sweetheart, was born. She finally had the opportunity to have a little girl, and she wasted no time dressing her in pink and spoiling her to no end. Rita and Henry spent their years following retirement, taking Jackie along for their long rides to see all the nature they enjoyed and showering her with love and kisses. Rita was a staple at Sunday football games at Steve and Sue's house, dancing to the halftime music and keeping the party going. Her laugh, quick wit, sense of humor, and unconditional love will be missed. That was Rita Teresa Berryman of Auburn. Next, Stephanie S. Claremont from Worcester and Shrewsbury. Stephanie S. Claremont, age 47, of Worcester and formerly of Shrewsbury, died peacefully on Saturday, April 6th. Calling hours will be 2 to 5 p.m. at the Britton Shrewsbury Funeral Home on April 14th. That was Stephanie S. Claremont. John Madison Davis, Sterling. It is with great sadness that we announce that fifth-generation farmer and founding father of Davis Farmland, John Madison Davis, age 86 of Sterling, Mass., died peacefully at home on Tuesday, April 9th, surrounded by his family after a courageous battle with acute myeloid leukemia. That was John Madison Davis of Sterling. And finally, Peter H. Woodbury, West Boylston. On the cusp of the solar eclipse, Peter Hall Woodbury died peacefully in his sleep on April 8th, 2024. Husband, dad, papa, brother, and friend, Peter left an indelible mark on so many lives and will be deeply missed. Printer by trade, Finnish carpenter by heart, Peter was born in Worcester on January 31st, 1951. He graduated from Worcester Academy and later from the University of Denver with a degree in psychology and furthered his education at Worcester Polytech Institute, back then known as the School of Industrial Management. After college, he enjoyed time in Breckenridge, Colorado, and Southwest Harbor, Maine, before returning to Worcester to join the family business, Woodbury and Company Incorporated, founded in 1879 as designers and producers of engraved commercial stationery. In his youth, he excelled at swimming, sailing, and snow skiing, and later enjoyed annual ski trips out west with his father and brother, and later with his daughter and son. He also enjoyed cycling and participated in the Pan Mass Challenge for a decade, even convincing his son to join him twice on the ride. Peter loved the outdoors, spending time at his family's cottage on Mount Desert Island, Maine, and creating a lifetime of memories boating, swimming, hiking, clearing the woods, and lighting bonfires on the beach. It was the love of his special place that motivated his daughter, Sarah, to build a home on the adjacent property, where her dad guided her every decision. Peter's love of the ocean led him to inspire his son, Chris, to become a boat captain, a source of great pride. He even had the opportunity to ride alongside his son on a few voyages north from Florida and St. Thomas to New England. So many stories resulted from these adventures. Peter and his wife Sharon cherished a special place in Martha's Vineyard where they married. Throughout their marriage, they shared a love for travel, and especially the frequent trips across Europe with their lifelong friends from Worcester. Always the calm in the roughest of seas, he was unflappable, and his family relied on his wisdom and protection. He leaves behind the love of his life, his wife of 43 years, Sharon A. Woodbury, formerly Sharon O'Brien, son Christopher Duclos and his wife Veronica, Sarah, his daughter Sarah, Neil and her husband, and their two children, Maya and Jack. Once again, that was Peter H. Woodbury of West Boylston. Well, that wraps up the obituaries for today, Thursday, April 11th. You're listening to the 12 noon, 1 hour live reading of the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. We'll take a break to hear from community news about Gardner, and we'll come back with Beverly with front page, local news, and other news.
Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week, including the Gardner News. You can hear the Gardner News every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Stay in touch with your community by tuning in to Audio Journal. The Gardner News, every Wednesday at 6 p.m.
Pickup crashes into Devon's Health Center. State police are investigating a fatal crash at a health center early Wednesday. About 5:30 a.m., a pickup slammed into a building at 85 Patton Road, listed as Tara Vista Behavioral Health Center. The Devon's Fire Department responded to the scene. The truck was on fire. State police confirmed that the driver of the truck is dead. No one in the building was injured, according to police. The cause of the crash is under investigation by state police assigned to the Worcester District Attorney's Office. Authorities have not released the identification of the pickup driver. Tara Vista, one of several businesses and organizations on the former Army base, provides inpatient psychiatric care. There were more than 100 patients at the facility at the time of the crash, according to CEO Francis Savageau. He said the tree hit an area of administrative offices and that the building is structurally sound. Patients and staff are all accounted for and unharmed, and at no time were in any danger, he told reporters at the scene. There is a photograph that accompanies this article, and it shows the pickup truck and in the front of the Tara Vista Health Center at 85 Patton Road. It does say that the truck caught fire and damaged the building. There it does not appear to be a lot of damage to the building, but the truck is not in the best of shape after that accident. Racial bias claimed in disciplining of students. Worcester NAACP blasts Nickel College and police. A letter penned by the Worcester chapter of the NAACP and the nonprofit organization Lawyers for Civil Rights claims two of the 10 students charged in connection with a melee on Nichols College grounds in October were unfairly disciplined by the school, alleging racial bias in the investigations and conducted by the college and the Dudley Police Department. The organizations demanded the reinstatement of the two students, Shamar Hall and Giovanni McLaughlin, and a full investigation of the college and the police department to root out racial bias and create effective mechanisms for reporting and responding to instances of hate, speech, and discrimination at both institutions. Hall and McLaughlin are among 10 students accused of ganging up on four other students in the early hours of October 29th, kicking them in the head and body on campus grounds during a large student gathering. Court records indicate that a female student said the fight started after she was involved in a physical squabble with one of the four alleged victims. Police statements and court records show that one student lost consciousness and suffered a concussion in the fight, while three other students who claimed to have intervened to help their friend suffered bruises and cuts. Mr. Hall and Mr. McLaughlin acted only in self-defense, said the letter by the NAACP and Lawyers for Civil Rights. Yet Nichols College took disciplinary action against them while failing to question or discipline any of the white students involved. The NAACP and Lawyers for Civil Rights state in their letter that Hall and McLaughlin, who say they were students with strong track records of campus leadership and academic achievement, were denied access to legal counsel during conduct hearings and were subjected to racially biased questioning. The letter also alleges that interviews by the Dudley Police Department excluded crucial testimony and primarily targeted black students for criminal action, and adds that racially charged hate speech on a Nichols College-sanctioned online platform went unaddressed in the investigations and resulting disciplinary actions. Court records showed that police used at least two cell phone videos to identify the accused students, with officer statements describing the content of the videos as showing the accused students kicking other students with shod feet and spitting on them. Police also used the testimony of the alleged victims to identify the charged students, at least five of whom were members of the Nichols College football team. Hall and McLaughlin are not among those listed on the roster. Hall is quoted in the letter by the NAACP and Lawyers for Civil Rights as saying that the college and the police department unfairly targeted us, putting our future at risk. Their actions overlooked the consequences for me and my family, Hall said. I hope this prompts both institutions to reconsider their approach to racial fairness. I want to make sure no one else after us feels this way or are treated this way. McLaughlin is quoted in the letter as saying he had never faced disciplinary actions at school and that Nichols College had always been a welcoming community where he had been involved in clubs. It's disheartening that some peers and others are misinformed about this incident, McLaughlin said. It's frustrating that there's now a negative perception of us for something we didn't initiate. We hope to reach a fair and just resolution for everyone. In their letter, the NAACP and Lawyers for Civil Rights requested an emergency meeting with the college and the police department to address their concerns to prevent the need for further legal action. Dudley Police Chief Marek Karlowitz said Wednesday that he is willing to meet with all parties involved and denied any racial bias in the department's investigation. Karlowitz, who in March identified the alleged victims as members of the Nichols College hockey team, added that he does not consider the melee to have been a fight, but more of an attack. He also denied any relation to the melee to sports or race, saying that the department did not find any grounds for the incident to be called a hate crime. The officer who investigated did try to speak with some of the suspects, but they all lawyered up before he was able to talk to them, said Karlowitz. We treat everybody with open-mindedness, and we go through a lot of training not to hold any biases against anyone. There's no evidence that the accused students acted in self-defense. This wasn't a fair fight. The victim was on the ground, all curled up trying to protect his head while everybody stomping on him. A spokesperson for the Nichols College said Tuesday that the college is aware of the letter by the NAACP and Lawyers for Civil Rights and is unable to comment further due to federal law and regulations that restrict access to the college's educational records, also adding that their conduct system is a confidential process. The college is not involved in the ongoing criminal procedure cited in the letter, said the spokesperson, and has confidence in the fairness of its student conduct system. Worcester Medical Director wants a long COVID clinic in the city. There is no disputing that the number of COVID-19 infections are at a minuscule level compared to the height of the pandemic in 2020 and 2021. However, COVID remains. The latest weekly numbers from the State Department of Public Health reported 676 confirmed cases from March 24th to March 30th and three confirmed deaths. There's also a phenomenon called long COVID, and its numbers appear robust. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports 17.4% of all U.S. adults 18 and older experienced long COVID between February 6th and March 4th in Massachusetts. It's 13.9% of all adults over the same one-month period. What is long COVID? The definition of long COVID is precise. Those exhibiting COVID-19 symptoms for at least 3 months after being diagnosed with an acute case of the virus. A positive test or a doctor's evaluation determines diagnosis. Symptoms are numerous, including fatigue, fever, difficulty breathing, and a cognitive malady known as brain fog. Effects can last for weeks, months, or years. In some cases, symptoms appear, disappear, and return. It's just one piece of the long COVID puzzle that has doctors and researchers scrambling to get a more complete understanding. There are many questions and not enough definitive answers, including how to diagnose long COVID, who is most at risk, and how to treat it. Currently, there is no treatment. A recent study in the UK and published in Nature Immunology showed long COVID leads to inflammation that doctors can detect in the blood. The findings mean a possible breakthrough against long COVID are existing drugs that regulate the immune system. Long COVID Clinic in Worcester. Dr. Michael Hirsch, Worcester's medical director and a pediatric surgeon at UMass Memorial Medical Center, wants to establish a long COVID clinic in Worcester. He knows it won't be easy, but he's determined to give a full faith effort. What we've learned from the pandemic is to be proactive, said Hirsch. The CDC is sending up smoke signals, and we're expecting to see many more patients declared having long COVID. The percentages from the CDC on the condition derive from a 20-minute online survey conducted by the National Center for Health Statistics. The CDC noted that the household pulse survey has limitations compared to more traditional in-person methods to establish disease benchmarks. Speed and real-time data were the goals of the online survey to hasten post-pandemic recovery. Hirsch is aware of the percentages and wants to model a Worcester clinic after one at Boston Medical Center. The hospital's ReCover Long COVID Clinic has doctors in various specialties who collaborate on patient care. Boston Medical Center didn't have a clinic doctor available to comment for this story. Like the Boston Medical Center Clinic, Hirsch envisions one-stop shopping for long COVID patients who can see various specialists under one roof. U.S. consumer prices rose in March. Annual inflation rate of 3.5%, up from February's 3.2%. Inflation ran hot for a third straight month in March, raising questions about what the Federal Reserve will feel confident that price pressures are subdued and it can begin cutting interest rates. Overall prices increased 3.5% from earlier this year, up from 3.2% in February, according to the Labor Department's Consumer Price Index. On a monthly basis, costs rose 0.4%, similarly to the previous month. Core prices, which exclude volatile food and energy items and are watched more closely by the Fed, increased 0.4%, in line with February's rise. That kept the annual increase at 3.8%. Inflation has slowed dramatically since reaching a 40-year high of 9.1% in June of 2022. But after rapid improvement in the fall, price increases have accelerated this year. Barclays expects the monthly price gains to slowly moderate, bringing down yearly inflation to 3% and core prices increases to 3.1% by the end of the year, still well above the Fed's 2% goal. Inflation is shaping up as a key issue in the presidential election. President Joe Biden said in a statement, the latest numbers show that while inflation has fallen more than 60% from its peak, more must be done to lower costs. Prices are still too high for housing and groceries, even as prices for key household items like milk and eggs are lower than a year ago, Biden said. Together, housing and gas accounted for more than half the monthly increase. Gasoline prices rose 1.7% in March, rent increased 0.4%, easing slightly from the prior month that nudged down the annual rise to a still elevated 5.7 from 5.8. It is now 12:24. You're listening to the Telegram and Gazette, a production of the Audio Journal. We'll pause for a message, and then I'll be back with the local news.
Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week, including the Gardner News. You can hear the Gardner News every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Stay in touch with your community by tuning in to Audio Journal. The Gardner News, every Wednesday at 6 p.m.
What's your vision?
My vision is 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye, zero vision in the left eye.
No, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, we believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/mcb.
Some nice light music for a nice light story. In the center of the local news, there's a heading that says, Spree for All. A tradition for more than a century in Worcester, Spree Day gives Clark University students a chance to set aside the books and laptops for a day of music, food, and games. Classes are canceled the day of the annual spring event, which dates to 1903. This year's Spree Day was Tuesday, with the nice weather and festive atmosphere helping keep minds off upcoming finals. And there are several photographs. There's one that shows students as they cheer and listen to the band Laundry Day during Spree Day on Tuesday. And then we have one of junior Charles Weiler of Carmel, New York, and senior Roxy Franz of Rochester, New York, sharing shade under an umbrella during Clark University's Spree Day on Tuesday. Alex Sweet, in another photo from Boston, he was there with Boston-based Daddy's Fried Dough preparing a treat for Clark University's Spree Day. And then we have a young lady, sophomore Maggie Connors of Medway, as she's waiting in line for fried dough at the Spree Day yesterday, and she is wearing a crown of daisies on her head. So good they planned it for yesterday and not today. Wouldn't have been much fun. Second arrest made in triple shooting. Three injured, one critically, on Sunday. Police arrested a second man Wednesday morning in connection with the triple shooting on Clarkson Street on Sunday night. Levon Atupum of Holden was taken into custody about 3 a.m. Wednesday in the area of Park Avenue in Worcester, according to Worcester Police. Atupum is charged with three counts of assault to murder with a firearm, accessory before the fact, and accessory after the fact. He is expected to be arraigned in Central District Court. Tuesday, Giordani Alejo, 19, of 51 Arlington Street, Worcester, was arraigned on three counts of armed assault to murder, as well as being an accessory after the fact. Alejo was allegedly the driver of a vehicle that transported others to and from the location where the shooting occurred, according to Assistant District Attorney Joseph Simmons and court documents. Alejo was identified as the driver by his mother, who owns the vehicle, a white 2017 Infiniti Q50, according to court documents. Addressing the court Tuesday, Simmons said Alejo dropped off two suspects around 9 p.m. Sunday in the vicinity of 9 Clarkson Street at the corner of Coral Street. According to the statement of facts in the Alejo case written by Detective Elias Baez, the two shooting suspects were armed with a firearm and an automatic firearm and fired down Clarkson Street, striking three victims. Monday, police said the three people hit by gunfire were two 18-year-old females and a 17-year-old male. They were rushed to a hospital after police officers initially treated them at the scene. The male victim suffered a life-threatening gunshot wound to the neck and is in critical condition, while the two females suffered gunshot wounds to the leg, according to court records. According to the statement of facts in the Atupum case, also written by Baez, a witness positively identified Atupum from a photo array as the person involved in the discussion to locate victims, drive suspects before the shooting, and drive off in his Acura after the incident. In addition, Atupum spoke with an unidentified person about the shooting on his cell phone using FaceTime, mimicking automatic gunfire with his mouth, according to the statement of facts. The two shooters are still at large. A GoFundMe account was created by a man who identified himself as the father of victim Miguel Rivera. According to the GoFundMe account created by Jose Rivera, Miguel has one major surgery and has many more major surgeries to come. After student burned by laptop in Uxbridge, the district cooked to collect devices. A student at Whiten Intermediate School suffered burns to the hands Tuesday morning when a laptop began emitting smoke during a standardized testing session, school officials said. The fire department was summoned and the school was evacuated. The student was taken to the hospital by a guardian, according to officials. The incident occurred about 9:30 a.m. as students were taking a Massachusetts Comprehensive Assessment System exam. The student was using a school-owned laptop, officials said. The safety of our students is paramount, and we will be taking the necessary steps to ensure that something like this does not occur in the future, Superintendent Michael Baldessari said. We would like to recognize the quick response of the staff members in the library who worked to evacuate students quickly and safely, as well as the Uxbridge Fire Department who responded to the scene. Testing of the students, grade 4 through 7, was put on hold. School officials said they had reached out to state education officials to determine the next step. After firefighters ventilated the building at 120 Granite Street, students and staff were allowed inside at 10:45 a.m. School officials said students throughout the district with school-issued Acer C734 Chromebooks will be asked to return them Wednesday and turn them in for evaluation. Acer is expected to supply the school with 450 replacement computers, according to school officials. A technician from the supplier was expected at the school Wednesday to examine the laptop that burned. Baldessari said, "We want to make sure we evaluate what happened with this unit before we move forward." And another article about a fire. Church damaged in blaze Tuesday. Probe underway for Howard Street fire. An investigation is underway after a fire at the Church of the Nativity on Howard Street broke out early Tuesday. Firefighters responded to an automatic alarm at the church about 1 a.m. Nothing of note was noticed at first, but upon entering the chapel area, firefighters were met with a large amount of smoke. Additional crews were summoned. While some firefighters were able to quickly contain the fire, other firefighters began removing religious items from the chapel. Church representatives soon arrived. "We knew that there were precious religious artifacts that are important to the congregation, so once it was safe, we prioritized saving them," the fire department said in a statement. Damage is estimated at $175,000, according to the fire department. The church said there is damage to both the nave and the preschool area of the building. "The church is the people, not the building, but our buildings are dear to us. Trust that we will do all we can to address our new reality and make speedy repairs," the church wrote in a post on social media and thanked firefighters for their swift response. The church said Sunday Eucharist will continue outdoors or in the parish hall. And there is a photograph that shows the fire burning at the church on Tuesday morning. It's now 12:32. You are listening to the Telegram Gazette, a production of the Audio Journal. We'll pause for another message, and then Harry will be back with business and sports.
What's going on in your town is important to you. Meetings that decide your taxes, changes in laws in your community, plans for new housing and businesses, and news about schools are all vital for you to know. Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week. In addition to the news of your community and area, you'll also hear about special events, stories about your neighbors, their businesses, their activities, and more. Stay in touch with your community on Audio Journal, broadcasting to print-impaired residents of Central Massachusetts.
And we're back. Now on to the business section of today's TNG for Thursday, April 11th, 2024. Our first story, Italy mulls penalties for AI-related crimes. Draft bill sets ground for national strategy on tech. By Elvira Polina and Angelo Amante, Reuters. Italy's government is considering tougher penalties for crimes using artificial intelligence tools, including market rigging and money laundering, according to a draft bill seen by Reuters on Tuesday. The 25-article draft bill lays down general principles on research, experimentation, development, adoption, and application of AI in Italy to cope with the impact of fundamental rights and related economic and social risk. The document, which is still subject to change, envisages use of such tools in the health sector and in the judiciary, focusing on its impact on job conditions. It also sets the groundwork for a national AI strategy. The draft beefs up penalties for market rigging through AI tools and stipulates that the use of AI for money laundering represents an aggravating element. It also sets out fines for copyright violations through AI and a jail term of up to 3 years for those who employ such tools to replace other persons, potentially targeting harmful deep fakes. Italy currently holds the rotating chair of the Group of Seven major democracies. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has said AI will be among the key issues of the 2024 presidency, which will culminate in a leaders' summit in the middle of June. AI has also become a crucial issue in the European Union. The bloc is moving closer to adopting the world's first rules on such tools, which have to comply with specific transparency obligations and EU copyright laws. In March, Meloni said she was planning to set up an investment fund to promote AI projects with an initial endowment of $1 billion. The fund could raise a further $2.2 billion from the private sector. Italy's cabinet is expected to give an initial green light to the bill by the end of April, two government sources said. The proposal will then be pushed through Parliament for any further revisions and final approval before becoming effective. Our second story in the business section, airlines struggle with lack of planes, facing squeeze as travel set to surpass records, by Rajesh Kumar Singh of Reuters. Chicago. The global airline industry is facing a summer squeeze, with travel demand expected to surpass pre-pandemic levels, while aircraft deliveries drop sharply due to production problems at Boeing and Airbus. Air carriers are spending billions on repairs to keep flying older, less fuel-efficient jets, and paying a premium to secure aircraft from lessors. But some carriers are still being forced to trim their schedules to cope with the lack of available planes. At the same time, the number of travelers globally is set to hit historic levels, with 4.7 billion people expected to travel in 2024, compared to 4.5 billion in 2019. We can expect a strong performance from airlines throughout the summer with some particularly high airfare, said John Grant, senior analyst at travel data firm OAG. Last December, the International Air Transport Association had predicted a 9% annual growth in global airline capacity this year. That estimate looks optimistic following Boeing's safety crisis. Passenger carriers will receive 19% fewer aircraft this year than they expected because of production issues at Boeing and Airbus, said Martha Neubauer, senior associate at Aerodynamic Advisory. U.S. carriers will receive 32% fewer aircraft than planned a year ago, because several airlines depend on Boeing's 737 MAX planes, Neubauer said. Boeing's production has been curbed after a January mid-air panel blowout. Boeing is reeling from a sprawling crisis that erupted after the January 5th Alaska Airlines blowout. Regulators have put a cap on production of the 737 MAX, but the company is not hitting even that level. As many as 650 Airbus A320 Neo jets could be grounded in the first half of 24 for inspections to deal with a flaw with RTX Core's Pratt & Whitney engines, RTX said last year. In Europe, low-cost airline Ryanair has cut some routes. In the U.S., United and Southwest have cut back flying and adjusted hiring and staffing plans. Analysts expect capacity at most U.S. carriers in the second quarter to grow at a slower pace than a year ago. Due to the shortage of new planes, the aircraft leasing market is booming. Data from Cirium Ascend Consultancy shows that lease rates for new Airbus A320-200neo and Boeing 737-8 MAX aircraft have hit 400,000 per month, the highest since mid-2008. Airlines are spending 30% more on aircraft leases than before the pandemic, said John Heimlich, chief economist at Airlines for America, which represents major U.S. carriers. They are also holding on to jets that are past their useful economic lives and require heavy maintenance that now takes several months, Heimlich said. Repair costs at United, Delta, and American were up 40% last year from 2019. The message here, folks, is get your airline tickets early, I believe. Citigroup CEO faces growth challenges. This is our last article in the business section. Overhaul, including layoffs, rattles workers at Citigroup. By Tatiana Bautzer and Saeed Azar from Reuters. New York. Citigroup investors have rewarded CEO Jane Fraser with a share price boost after Fraser announced a sweeping overhaul of Citi's sprawling structure in September, cutting costs by laying off 5,000 employees. Next, they want to see growth in wealth management and investment banking. Wall Street investors have welcomed Fraser's overhaul, but warned the CEO has major challenges ahead to boost returns and catch up with rivals, including regulatory problems, lackluster earnings, and an unsettled workforce. If this was a chess game, I would say the opening phase is over, and now the middle phase begins, said Peter Nerby, an analyst at ratings agency Moody's. Citi's stock is so depressed that it is hard to lose money betting on it, said Daniel Bapkes, portfolio manager at Pazena Investment Management, which manages more than $60 billion and owns Citi shares. We are confident the bank can control expenses after the reorganization, and it has strong growth prospects in corporate banking, he said. Citigroup shares rose 49% since it announced the overhaul in mid-September, outpacing a 26% climb for the KBW Bank Index. But the company's turnaround efforts also caused internal turmoil. Workers avoided signing up to long-term projects during the six-month reorganization because they were unsure if they would be laid off, said a source who declined to be identified discussing personnel matters. The process was lengthy because it affected many levels of the organization, said a separate source close to the company. The outlook for Citi is improving because of its job cuts, the quality of its loan portfolio, and its reduced exposure to paper losses on securities, said Ian Lappy, a portfolio manager at Gabelli Funds, which oversees $30 billion and owns Citi shares. Citigroup's reshuffle represents an inflection point that will increase its efficiency, said Hunter Doble, a portfolio manager at Hotchkiss and Wiley, which has $31 billion under management and owns shares of Citi. Meeting the bank's target of 11 to 12% return on tangible equity will fuel a big jump in the stock, given that its current profitability is much lower and will get closer to industry peers, Doble said. Citi will report its first quarter earnings Friday and hold a virtual shareholders meeting on April 30th. It lost $1.8 billion in the fourth quarter after taking several one-off charges that included losses with currency devaluation in Argentina and higher contributions to the FDIC that insures deposits. Its biggest challenges are improving profits in banking and wealth management, according to NIRBE at Moody's. I'm going to take a quick break, and then I will come back to sports. Stay tuned. A master plan for Woods, that's Tiger Woods, mission hasn't changed when he competes at Augusta National, by Adam Shupak of Golf Week. Tiger Woods has been playing at Augusta National Golf Club long enough that he remembers his first trip down Magnolia Lane in darkness in 1995. During his Masters debut, he stayed at the Crow's Nest, the intimate accommodations for amateur champions in the white antebellum clubhouse, and watched Sam Snead, Byron Nelson, and Gene Sarazen hit the opening tee shot on Thursday morning. Just 2 years later, Tiger Woods won his first of five green jackets in record fashion and set the menu for the champions' dinner, and smiled at the memory of watching the three legendary champions drinking my milkshakes. For Woods, the mission hasn't changed. He'd like to win a sixth green jacket at the 88th Masters and tie Jack Nicklaus for the most career victories at the Masters, pick up his 16th career major championship and 83rd official PGA Tour title, to break a tie with Sam Snead for the most victories in a career. If everything comes together, I can get one more, he said of the green jacket during his Tuesday pre-tournament press conference. Our next story in sports. Titans top Colonials in Mid-Wachusett A. Girls lacrosse. Algonquin 12, Shrewsbury 9, Grace Chioda netted 6 goals, Bella Roman added 3, and Ella Knopfsinger chipped in 2 as the host Titans edged the Colonials. Aaron Biss notched a hat trick for Shrewsbury, and teammate Paige O'Donnell contributed 2 goals and an assist. Also in lacrosse, Tantasqua 8, Worcester 5. Katie O'Neill, Tyler Sexton, and Abby Wharton each scored twice while lifting the host Warriors. Natalie Boucher and Catherine Brophy both had 2 goals for the Wildcats. Next game, Wachusett 19, Minichog 17. Riley Leary collected 6 goals and 5 assists. Kathleen Head had 6 goals and 2 assists. And Meg Jones added 5 goals and 2 assists to lift the Mountaineers in Wilbraham. Leominster 18, Neshoba 13. Caitlin Cudahy connected for 9 goals, and Emma Miller Ayala netted 6 to boost the visiting Blue Devils. Caroline Pinto scored 5 goals for the Wolves, and Kayla Flanagan added 2 goals and 4 assists. Tingsboro 17, North Middlesex 6. That was 17-6. Bella Adams had 5 goals and an assist. Lillian Gikas collected 4 goals and assist. Katie Gilmut gathered 3 goals and 1 assist. Moving on to the next sports story. Commentary. NIL is killing college sports, but who has the will to save it? By Greg Doyle of the USA Today Network. Glendale, Arizona. In the most charming of ways, Matt Painter sounded another alarm on the future of college basketball the day before the 2024 NCAA title game. Who's listening? Nobody, other than the 1.1 million folks who saw the quote on my Twitter feed and used it for their own purposes before moving on to the next bright and shin. Squirrel! Twitter is a problem, but don't expect me to fix everything, okay? Firing Elon Musk into the sun will solve that one, but a guy like me can do only so much. And today the issue everyone is ignoring, after laughing and moving on, is the downward spiral of college sports. Enough of my blathering. Here's Painter, Sunday, speaking at the most perfect place and the most perfect audience, his news conference the day before the 24 title game, with NCAA officials and national college basketball media in the room, and delivering a message most of us have already forgotten. There's a marketing rule, the Rule of Seven, that states something like this. Most people need to hear a message seven times before it sinks in. You know how those radio and TV ads tell you a phone number, then repeat it two or three times or seven times? They realize you and me, we're not really paying attention, so we need to hear a message until our ears are bleeding for it to register. So please hear Matt Painter's message, edited for brevity, before college basketball bleeds out. NIL wasn't put in place, so who's ever got the most money gets the best players. Okay, well, that wraps up the sports. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back with more news. Stay tuned.
Would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune into Audio Journal every Thursday at 4 p.m.
Now, some news related to the eclipse. This is from the People, Places, and Things section of the paper. How to know if your eyes are damaged from the eclipse. Maybe you couldn't resist. The temptation to look at the solar eclipse without proper eye protection was strong for many people, and if you were among them, you may be wondering about the damage. Staring directly at the sun without safety eyewear can cause irreversible eye damage within seconds, according to the Adler Planetarium. Eclipse observers probably would not register pain because there are no nerve endings inside the eye. If your eyes or vision feel off, it could be a sign of solar retinopathy when light damages the retina. Exposure of the retina to intense visible light causes damage to the light-sensitive rod and cone cells, Dr. Ralph Chow of the University of Waterloo in Canada said on his website. The light triggers a series of complex chemical reactions within the cells, which damages their ability to respond to a visual stimulus, and extreme cases can destroy them. The pain of looking at the sun is not instant, and the same goes for symptoms of damage. Someone may not know they experience solar retinopathy until hours after exposure, according to the National Center for Biotechnology Information. The American Academy of Ophthalmology said visual symptoms typically begin within a few to 6 hours, but some can experience them after 12 hours. According to the Academy, symptoms after staring at the sun may include blurry vision, a headache, a blind spot in your central vision in one or both eyes, increased sensitivity to light, distorted vision such as a straight line appearing bent or changes in the way you see color, a dyschromatopsia. Most eclipse viewers are probably fine, experts say. Even if their eyes are strained, the effect could be temporary. About 100 documented cases of eye damage were reported after the 2017 total solar eclipse across the U.S. and Canada, according to NPR. Though there is no treatment for solar retinopathy, it's still necessary to visit an ophthalmologist if you have difficulties with your vision, the Ophthalmology Academy says. Some will suffer from permanent vision loss in the form of a small blind spot and distortion. The point of that story is if you are experiencing any changes in your vision, certainly contact your eye doctor and have your eyes checked to be sure that you did not experience any kind of permanent damage to your eyes during the eclipse, which was spectacular. Now, from the People in the News section, Jay Leno was granted conservatorship over estate of wife Mavis. Jay Leno has been declared the conservator of his wife Mavis Leno's estate amid the philanthropist's battle with dementia. Leno, who filed the petition for the conservatorship in Los Angeles court in January, has had his request granted during a hearing Tuesday, according to court documents obtained by USA Today. The court finds clear and convincing evidence that a conservatorship of the estate is necessary and appropriate in that Mavis Leno is unable to care for her financial affairs and is subject to undue influence, the minute order said. Mavis consented to the ruling and did not object to the conservatorship of the estate per the filing. "Everything you're doing is right," Judge Brenda J. Penny told Leno in court, according to People magazine. "I totally understand this is a difficult period." Leno shared during the hearing that he is in the process of estate planning and reviewing Mavis' will, the magazine reported. It is now 12:56 and time to close.
This local news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Programming is funded in part by the Memorial Foundation for the Blind, the Mass Commission for the Blind, and Unibank. If you have any suggestions for our program, please call 508-797-1117 and let us know. We would love to hear from you. Have a great day, everyone.
Once again, Audio Journal listeners, this is Bill Ruggiero giving the latest weather forecast for Thursday, April 11th, 2024. Here's my latest updated weather forecast. For today, we're looking at mostly cloudy skies with scattered showers today. Highs near 56 degrees. We'll have a southeast winds at 10 to 15 miles per hour, gusts to 13 miles an hour in the afternoon. For tonight, mostly cloudy skies with rain. Rain may be heavier times with possible embedded thunderstorms late. Low will be near 46 degrees. Now for your Friday, it's called for heavy rain and thunderstorms in the morning, otherwise tapering to just light showers in the afternoon. Highs Friday near 56 degrees. Friday night, mostly cloudy skies with an early evening shower, otherwise clearing after midnight. Low will be near 40 degrees, and the outlook for Saturday is called for mostly sunny skies with just a chance of a shower or a thunderstorm likely in the afternoon. Highs Saturday near 65 degrees. Saturday night, mostly clear skies, low around 44 degrees, and the outlook for Sunday is called for mostly sunny skies, highs Sunday near 71 degrees. It looks like we're back into the 60s on Monday and Tuesday. Expect a chance of rain on Wednesday into Thursday of next week. This has been Bill Ruggiero saying have a good and happy day, everybody, and please stay tuned for more programming coming up next on Audio Journal. Take care. Have a wonderful Thursday, everybody. Bye.
Hello, sports fans. Did you know that Audio Journal has a weekly one-hour program that features news and inspiring stories about disabled and visually impaired folks participating in sports at the local, national, and international level? That's AJ Sports Page. Tune in on Fridays from 5 to 6 p.m. That's AJ Sports Page, airing every Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Archived episodes are available on demand on our website, www.audiojournal.org. That's AJ Sports Page, a production of Audio Journal. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.